I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Our guest, Sarah Laffer Hurdy, is a wife, a mother of three, and a hardcore career woman. She's out to shatter the mommy myths perpetrated by American culture, and she wants to do it with science and evolutionary biology. Women are not necessarily maternal, she says. They're not born that way, and they didn't evolve that way either. Women can be competitive, calculating, aggressive. They're strategists, opportunists, and deal makers. Sarah Laffer Hurdy looks at animals to understand human females. She has studied rats, bees, birds, kangaroos, apes, and fruit flies to discover a life form alien to what Darwin and her own male graduate school professors had taught her. Evolution is not driven by the male sex drive alone, surely, but also by female shrewdness. A perfect mother, according to Sarah Laffer Hurdy, is more like Flo, the droopy-lipped chimpanzee mother made famous by Jane Goodall, and less like June Cleaver. Flo wasn't simply a doting nurturer, she was an entrepreneurial dynast. We're talking straight this hour about motherhood in nature and in modern American life. Connection listeners, what do you think is natural and what's not in your experience of motherhood? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK to make the Mother Nature connection with Sarah Laffer Hurdy. Her new book is Mother Nature, A History of Mothers, Infants, and Natural Selection. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Sarah Hurdy, welcome. We've got a lot of ground to cover, and you know it all. I mean, the personal experience, but also the evolutionary biology on this whole subject. I wish you'd just explain what is and isn't natural, found in nature, found in animal history in general, among all sorts of things we worry about and argue about and talk about on this program and at home these days, including the whole question of working moms, daycare, the maternal instinct, daddy roles, mating, dating, single parenthood, nuclear families, feminism. How many of these arguments have roots and history in the natural story?
Wow. Well, I love your enthusiasm and your ambition for this topic. But let's start with the self-sacrificing moms, the mom of legend, the mom that we really have in mind when we think of maternal instincts. She's out there, but she's pretty uncommon. You find her typically in species like the Australian social spider, where the mother is only breeding once and then she's dying. And that's a classic example of after her brood is produced, she becomes exceedingly mushy. And I don't mean sentimental. She starts to liquefy and her babies eat her up. This is a self-sacrificing mother, and it's because she is
over-the-top motherhood.
She is a simulparous breeder. That means she's going to breed just once in her life, like salmon going upstream and then breeding and dying. Humans, of course, like all primates, are iteroparous breeders. That means we breed again and again over a long life. Mm-hmm. And that means we make trade-offs. Trade-offs between growing, survival, self-maintenance, and then reproduction. How much energy we can put into producing our enormously costly human babies and rearing them. So that all primate mothers, and in particular human mothers, have always had to make these trade-offs. And I'm not suggesting that mothers today live in the same kinds of worlds as mothers in the past. Mm. But I am saying they confront the same dilemmas. But the world has changed.
Speak of it before we had cars or careers or advanced education or this kind of thing. I mean, where in human history do you see the roots of the dilemma of the working mother, for example?
Well, the dilemma of
the career mother.
That's new. When I compare the opportunities I've had in my own life to those of women just 100 years ago, there were no professional options for women, certainly not in science. And, you know, I start off talking about women 150 years ago, the contemporaries of Charles Darwin. And there they were, really interested in evolutionary theory, with a lot to say about it. They were right there on the scene, tapping Darwin on the shoulder, saying, "Excuse me, Mr. Darwin, I think this is a wonderful idea, but I think you left something out, the other half of the species. We need to look at it from female perspective." Well, now, 150 years later, 130 years later, 37% of the PhDs in biology are to women, and women are making contributions to this field, and perspectives that were kind of shunted aside 100 years ago are now fully incorporated. Really, in the last 25 years, this has happened. Female perspectives have been incorporated into evolutionary biology.
How are they putting the whole study on a different track?
Well, there's so many ways in which considering things from a female as well as a male perspective, considering the continuous dialectic between male and female interests, because male and female interests don't always coincide, changes the way we think about relations between the sexes. And then there are other ways, too. For example, maternal effects. We've started to think much more about what a mother has done in her own life, the status she has achieved, the resources that she has gained access to, how these non-genetic attributes of a mother are passed on to her offspring and determine the survival chances of her own offspring.
Be concrete with that. I mean,
well, Flo. I mean, you raised the example of Flo, Chris, and she's one of my all-time favorites. Anyone who watched Jane Goodall's wonderful National Geographic shows on TV remembers this devoting, doting mother. But the Flo that has emerged now in the last really 10 years in the chimp literature is a very different animal. What we know is that Flo was dominant to other females around her, and because of that, she was able to kind of commandeer for herself and her offspring a safe and very fruitful territory. Her own daughter, Fifi, goes on to achieve the lifetime record of any wild chimp for reproductive success, 7 surviving offspring. And her own daughter has now broken that record, breeding at an early age, producing more offspring. And what's really interesting, because, of course, for years we thought that chimps were male, philopatric, that the sons stay around. Well, not if you can swing it. Flo's daughter Fifi stayed in her mother's range and inherited her mother's territory. Half of Fifi's own daughters are doing that as well. So it's kind of like, if you can swing it, you stay put. And she used her position, her managerial position, vis-a-vis other females and males, and she had a lot of help from her sons, too, old Flo. She used her strategic abilities to become a dynast, really.
We joke about that as bonobo behavior, not chimp behavior.
Yeah.
Guys rule in chimp land, but bonobo is the world of that kind of feminist, matriarchal sort of model. What's the truth of it, are you saying?
Well, I love bonobos, too. When bonobos first started to come on the scene, and we've only been learning about them for the last 10 years or so, really learning, and the horrible truth is that they may be extinct before we really learn anything about them. But the thing about bonobos is that females do have an extraordinary degree of leverage relative to males, and they're able to take feeding priority when they both want some food. And they do this through forming alliances with other unrelated females. One of my students, Amy Parrish, was able to show how females use sexual relations with other females to develop these very close ties. And these alliances allow females to prevail over males in bonobo society. Well, when this stuff first started coming out from Cano and Parrish and Duvall, people thought this was a figment of feminist imaginations. And I was always very cautious citing the bonobo work because I'm
always wary of it. I mean, when people make this the example for human human life. You know they're grinding some sort of a contemporary political axe. But go ahead.
Well, the point is not that they are a model for contemporary life. The point is that they are a viable alternative paradigm for our ancestors, and that we have assumed this very patriarchal model for our great ape ancestors, and that remains there as one alternative model. But we must give equal weight now to this other bonobo alternative model, and also to the revised chimp model, because, you know, we're finding out they're not necessarily these brotherhoods of chimps that rule the roost. They may or may not be related, especially now with the results from the West African study site, Pascal Gagnon, Christophe Bosch, and so forth, showing that half the offspring at the Thai chimp study site were sired by males from another community. So that these brotherhoods patrolling their females and controlling them, the picture is now a little shakier than it was 5 years ago.
Our guest Sarah Hurdy speaks in a certain way, as she said, for a whole lot of science in almost 150 years since Darwin, that is including that other half of the species in the story. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. I want you to speak again against the background of evolutionary biology and natural life to some of the other dilemmas that drive people nuts in this society today. For example, so much worry about single motherhood and the burdens on the single mothers to begin with, but the children, the society. What does the natural history tell you about those arguments?
Well, what natural history, and by that I mean a comparative look across the ethnographic record for humans, what the ethnographic record tells me is that fathers are very important, that not having a father does typically, especially in hunter-gatherer foraging societies, puts children at a real disadvantage. There's no question that dads are important. The problem is dads are not always reliable. They may defect. They may go someplace else. There's high adult male mortality in a lot of these hunting societies. They may die. They may become involved with another woman. They may try to bring in an extra mate so that their contributions might be diluted in that way. So fathers are important. They're not always reliable. Having a reliable male to help you raise your family is kind of a luxury. Because hunting, you have to remember, is a dicey way to make a living. There are a lot of times when men come in without, quote, a paycheck. And when we assume that what we call the decline of the nuclear family falling apart in the inner cities, and we point to things like birth control, feminism, social decay, we assume this is new. I don't think this is new. I think this is a time-honored human response to particular ecological and social circumstances. Fathers who are not reliable or who cannot reliably support their family. Now, I happen to be a big fan of the monogamous companionate marriage. However, this does not give me the right to project this onto my ancestors and say this is how we've always lived. It's a luxury to be able to live that way, to have a situation where a man and a woman can support their kids and that's all they need, provide everything that's needed, and a woman can count on her mate to stick around. This is a luxury, and it's probably a good thing so far as kids are concerned, but it doesn't give us the right to assume our ancestors lived that way or that humans necessarily should live that way.
You make the point that the male and female interests, and that was your word, are different, and that the female interest has been neglected in the sort of Darwinian tradition. What about the instincts, and what about the nurturing instincts of dads? What about stay-at-home dads and fathers who want to, or in the few who choose to, be the principal caregiver?
Well, Darwin actually was very curious about this, as was George Eliot. They both wanted to know, are they these latent maternal emotions in men? And Eliot called it the maternal component present in men and women. And the answer is yes, they are there. But the threshold for responding to infants is set a little bit higher. And so you can find all these amazing examples in species where men or male gorillas or male langurs are not famous for going around caring for infants. Under some circumstances, it tends to be when there's the infant has a real need, when there's a relationship between the man and the mother, and when there's prolonged proximity between the infant. You do find male care of infants, and recently a group of researchers in Canada, Ann Story, have been able to show by looking at prolactin levels and testosterone levels and cortisol levels that men exposed to pregnant women and then present at the birth and then after birth, you start to see, not at the same dosage levels, but in the same patterns, the same kinds of hormonal changes in men. In both monkeys and humans, males who carry babies around a lot, prolactin levels get elevated.
Isn't that tremendously interesting? I was just going to say, what you don't find is men lactating and nursing children, which is an important point in your scheme.
It takes a lot to get a male to lactate. It takes a lot of commitment. It takes a lot of kneading of the nipples, and it probably takes some extra hormones.
But do you mean that it could happen? It does.
Yes, it can be done. There's some
to
side
the point
effects.
Of nourishing an infant.
Yes, it can be done.
Granting
it's not,
that
it's
an extraordinary.
It's a feat. It's an extraordinary feat. And it's much easier to do in grandmothers. Grandmothers who've nursed a baby, and who haven't given birth recently, who haven't even been fertile in the recent past, can resume lactating. But it takes a lot.
What does lactating have to do with it? It's a big deal in your scheme of things.
Well, yes, lactating is something that tied the mother to her infant since the origins of mammals. And a lot of the more interesting affiliation-producing, love-producing, love-inducing hormones like oxytocin really start to come on board the evolutionary story with mammals. Prior to mammals, you had either no one caring, you take the eggs and let them hatch and they're on their own, like turtles, or else you had, as in very common in birds still extant today, you have both males and females. And so, for example, if you think about the equivalent of milk in birds, like crop milk in flamingos, it sounds kind of nasty, but baby birds like it a lot. It's the lining of the esophagus. There are all these cells and mucus there, and the parents, both sexes, male and female, cough it up. It's called crop milk, and they put it into the mouths of babies. So that really the thing about lactation is it was sex specific. Only one parent, only the mother could do this for her babies. So that changed a lot, and it certainly changed a lot in terms of thresholds of responding. Mothers have a much lower threshold for responding to cues. You know, the cries of babies, I mean, it goes right through you. It goes through the mom sooner and at a higher level of reaction than it does the dad.
But is it an insuperable obstacle to nurturing daddyism?
No. Talk about the partly joking, the idea of mothers wearing earplugs when you first bring the baby home from the hospital to give the dad a chance to get there first. Now, obviously, if he's a real deadbeat, she needs to take her earplugs out and go on and take care of her kid.
Maybe just give him a hearing aid or something.
I love that.
An amplifier.
Yeah. give dad an amplifier or a shot of prolactin or whatever it takes. And once the dad gets into the mode of responding, he's in proximity to this baby. The baby becomes as attached or more attached to dad as to mom, because babies respond to the people who are going to reliably meet their needs. And so dad is a sympathetic guy. He's always there. Baby loves dad as much as mom, or loves dad more. This is the way to keep dads investing for longer than, the usual 10 minutes.
You're revising the mommy model here. What's the daddy model that comes, that's implied?
Well, it depends on the local ecology and the local history. But of course, in our society, we have a long history of men living around their relatives, patrilocality, patrilineal inheritance, which means that men are a better bet, sons are a better bet than daughters to inherit resources and to keep them safe, so that men have greater resource holding potential than daughters do, parents bias towards sons, institutions bias towards sons. And what I'm talking about, of course, is a prescription for full-fledged patriarchy. And this is where the West has been for many, many generations. We're now moving out of that, right? I mean, we're moving into what I call an era of lapsed patriarchy. Mm. And things are kind of up for grabs. And we have laws now, these wonderful laws that protect my property and protect my body. And, you know, people can't just march in and kill my babies, can't just drag me off. This is kind of wonderful. And these laws are changing the rules.
In place of
in place of my brother and father coming to my aid, we have Big Brother. We have the state who are protecting women's rights. And changing, really, the rules of existence in this lapsed patriarchy. But it's an uncomfortable thing. I mean, men...
Lapsed patriarchy. We're going to have to come back to that. I want to also hear more about alpha males and how, in an era of lapsed patriarchy, even men may be looking for different kinds of model leaders. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Mother Nature connection with our guest, Sarah Hurdy, who's a wife and mother, but also one of the great social anthropologists and evolutionary scientists of our time. Her new book is called Mother Nature, A History of Mothers, Infants, and Natural Selection. 1-800-423-TALK. Cheryl is calling from Laconia, New Hampshire.
Hi.
Hey, Cheryl. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good. In an era of lapsed patriarchy, I'm just hanging on.
Well, I'm calling because I want to get the opinion of Sarah in regards to natural selection of our children. With modern medicine today, parents are actually, let's say, forced to not naturally select their children. Now, I think that Hitler kind of ruined the whole eugenics movement by taking it to the awful extreme that he did. But, I mean... When you look at a healthy baby or a baby that has mental, physical problems, in natural selection, that baby wouldn't survive. And so today, I think we've reversed that. And eventually, I think it's going to make our population weaker. From an evolutionary perspective, from a scientific perspective, obviously not from an emotional perspective, but...
Cheryl, I respect where you're coming from, and your argument is a eugenic one, and you're absolutely right that one of the terrible consequences of what Hitler did is that we are no longer able to discuss these issues openly in a rational manner, and as a society, we really do need to begin to do that, and you're absolutely right on that. Though, you know, it's interesting, they are respects in which all of us right now are practicing eugenics without even thinking about it or calling about it that. If, for example, you think about the laws in your state, it's against the law to marry your very close relative. It's against the law for brothers and sisters to marry. This is actually a eugenic law. So we're doing it, but not calling it that. We're not talking about it. I agree with you, Cheryl. We need much more open discussion about
it. But what is
issues.
The natural and the animal guide to this?
Well, the natural and the animal guide to this raises questions that for most people are ethically extremely troubling. Because Cheryl is quite right that in nature you do have species which routinely prune their litters, golden hamsters, for example, the smallest ones are weeded out. And I think it's very likely that in foraging human societies, premature infants were discriminated against and not kept. This was a viable a reasonable thing because they had no way to keep them alive. It was a very bad bet to try. Mm. Modern medicine has created just a real rat's nest of dilemmas. And I am not, of course, equipped to discuss these ethical issues. I study what is and why. Mm. I really am not qualified to talk about what should
be. Well, it's obviously a huge subject. And it wasn't just Hitler who made it difficult to talk about. I mean, there are a lot of good reasons that it ought to be difficult to talk about. Is there any one place where you'd want to begin a discussion about it?
Well, an obvious case is the ease with which the lack of thought we give to things like fertility drugs that produce multiple young, and then carrying quintuplets through. It's already an artificial situation. Shouldn't we be more thoughtful about how we're going to handle this? I mean, that's an obvious place to be.
Sarah Hurdy is our guest. Her book is Mother Nature. We're talking about the background in evolutionary biology and in animal science of all manner of questions and dilemmas about modern motherhood. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
This is WBU.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Sarah Hurdy is our guest, a scientist, social anthropologist, but encompassing evolutionary psychology and history. Her new book is called Mother Nature, A History of Mothers, Infants, and Natural Selection. She's been a major scientist and a controversial writer for 20-some years now. You write in the book, in the new book, that a colleague that you greatly respect, a sociobiologist, had commented on your work in general to a reporter. He said, my own view is that Sarah Hurdy, ought to devote more time and study and thought to raising a healthy daughter. That way, misery won't keep traveling down the generations. Sounds like a very old-fashioned kind of put-down. How have you not just managed your work and your motherhood, but how has this whole conversation sort of traveled back and forth into your professional and your private life?
My poor colleague who said that, because
he's paying now.
He's so often quoted. And the truth is, he was simply a particularly articulate spokesman of what really was a very widespread view when I was at Harvard. It was fine to educate women as long as they didn't want to go to graduate school and go on to be professionals. I was the first woman that my own advisor ever had as a graduate student. And there's no question that the Harvard of the early 1970s discriminated against women in all kinds of ways. And hopefully this has changed massively since then. And, you know, it was obvious that my professor who said this had children of his own, which he was leaving at home. My husband was doing research in infectious diseases, and he was off at the lab. But somehow it was me, just me, who was supposed to stay home so that misery wouldn't keep on going down the generations. But, you know, at the time, it was not the unfairness of this logic that really struck me. It was the nagging possibility that he was right. And, you know, as a primatologist, I knew that you most often see mothers in close contact with their babies, and that mother chimps and mothers in traditional foraging societies carry their babies everywhere. And so there was a nagging anxiety. Is he right? And that was part of the motivation for the years and years of research on
how did you how did you resolve it in your own head?
Well, one of the things that I've learned, which really came as just a revelation to me, was to realize that, you know, we look out at a Kung San or Bushman woman, and she's walking miles and miles carrying her children with her. It's really typical to see a woman with a 30-pound toddler on her back, enormously pregnant, 25 pounds of nuts she's just gathered, plus the water she needs. She'll walk during the 4 years before her child is really kind of at least independently mobile from her, 5,000 miles carrying all this stuff. And I think about that, and it looks like she's meant to be there with her kids, and then I realize, why is she carrying those kids? Because when we look across species, across primates, and across human societies, and look at it comparatively, the mothers who have the best daycare, that is infant-sharing monkeys, where individuals other than the mother, call them allo mothers, will come and carry her baby for her. They're very interested in holding and carrying it. Mm-hmm. In human societies where kin are there and they pass babies around from birth, other women in the group may actually provide breast milk for the babies. Societies with good daycare, whether they're monkey or ape or human, guess what? Those mothers are breeding at a faster rate with higher infant survival prospects. And all of a sudden, there is a new question. Well, why isn't everybody using daycare? Why? I mean, if we look at the crass coinage of evolutionary biology, which is reproductive success, why isn't everybody using allo mothers, individuals other than the mother, to help breed? The answer is it's not always safe, and they're not always available. What the answer is not is that it's unnatural.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, I didn't realize it till just a few years ago. But I mean, it's really in the course of this research that it's come out.
So the short form is that mothers who use allomothers, kin or otherwise, when they have a chance, win the evolutionary game.
Mm-hmm.
Does it work that way in contemporary human society?
Well, that remains
in modern
to be
society.
Seen. That remains to be seen. And also, let's put into this equation here. We don't want our lives ruled by what was evolutionarily stable in the past. I mean, I don't want to judge my life by my reproductive success. I want to judge my life by my own terms. Was I a good person? Did I achieve my goals? Was I creative and productive? Do my kids have nice lives? Are they happy? You know, Mother Nature, which is my metaphor for natural selection, really doesn't care whether I'm happy or my kids are happy. Mm. Mother Nature is only interested in reproductive success. And if we look at nature as a prescription for how we should behave instead of how creatures in the past have behaved, it's really bad luck to be born either sex or any species. You know, I don't want Mother Nature determining how I should live my life. So that's not going
to
help.
You've made a big effort in the book and elsewhere to consider also the infant, the child perspective.
Yes.
What does that tell you, in short, on some of these questions?
Well, it tells us that children don't just have desires, they have real needs. And, you know, I am a feminist, but what I realize is that feminists, because they were responding to a very androcentric perspective in evolutionary biology, have rejected all this stuff about attachment theory. John Bowlby, who's really the father of attachment theory, is really pilloried by feminists.
What's the attachment theory?
Well, he seems to be arguing that an infant becomes attached to its mother, and the punchline seems to be that only the mother will do. And it's really where Trivers was coming from in that line that you cited, Sarah should stay home with her baby so misery won't keep going down the generations. But what I believe is that humans evolved as cooperative breeders, which means that mothers evolved to elicit care from wherever they could. If that care was not forthcoming, they bail out, which is why maternal commitment is so dicey, is so contingent on social circumstances in the human species. Well, that has produced selection pressures on infants. Infants evolved, human infants, to be connoisseurs of mothers, to constantly monitor their caretakers for the kind of commitment they can expect. You know, is she going to give whole hog? Is she going to retrench a little bit? Because if she's going to retrench on her maternal diet, I need to cry. I need to get her attention. I need to. But the other thing, and it's kind of disturbing to realize, is that if I'm right, that humans, infants, are pursuing quite different developmental pathways depending on how much commitment they perceive is going to be forthcoming from their kin groups, from mothers and those around her, and daycare workers in our own society. The as-if kin is what I call daycare workers. It's a constructed extended family that we artificially produce. Daycare workers are allo mothers with more or less commitment to your kid. infants evolve to monitor this situation and really develop personalities that are going to be adaptive, where they can count on a lot of help, or where maybe they can't, where they're going to have to just take what they need because nobody's going to give it to them.
Sarah Hurdy is our guest, student of Mother Nature in science, in evolutionary history, in her own life. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. Gina is on the line.
Hi, good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Gina.
I wanted to ask your guest, we have so many different styles of mothering in our society, and even, I would suggest, a differential in the quality of those styles. I wonder if you see that kind of variety in the animal world. In other words, are there good mothers and bad mothers in the animal world, or is that just...
Soft moms and hard moms, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful question, Gina. And in the last 10 years, primatologists have started to address it. Gene Altman, for example, a professor of biology at Princeton, has been looking at styles of mothering really since 1980, but focusing on it in the last 10 years as their long-term study of baboons living at Amboseli in Kenya has begun to yield information over generations. I mean, this study has gone on for decades now so that they can look at a mother and say, well, she was a really terrific mother. How are her kids? Well, it turns out for baboons that the best predictor of maternal style is rank. And as Gene Altman identified years ago, you have these laissez-faire mothers who tend to be high-ranking, and then the much more possessive mothers who are very worried about anybody else getting near their infant, and these are subordinate. But beyond these big cutoffs, there are also temperamental differences in mothers. So the answer to your question is, and I only mentioned the case of baboons because that's where we know it best. It's also the case for chimps and macaques. The answer to your question is yes, there is tremendous variation in maternal styles among non-human as well as in human.
But what's the implication for our society? I mean, does this mean that women with rank, power moms, moms in the boardroom, can do that and be great mothers too?
No, because unfortunately, the way our society is set up, the workplace for power moms and the nurseries are really not available to one another. And I have to say, being a power mom creates real dilemmas for being a hands-on mom in our society. And I think that, you know, we do have a lot of neglected children out there as a consequence, but that's only one of many reasons why we have neglected children in our society.
1-800-423-8255. Gina, thank you. 1-800-423-TALK is the connection phone. We're talking about Mother Nature with the social anthropologist Sarah Hurdy. Pat is on the line.
Oh, hello, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure, Pat.
I had one comment and one question. First, my comment was in regard to Ms. Hurdy's statement that hormones perhaps play quite a role in all of this. And I thought one amusing anecdote which tends to support her statement about grandmothers lactating is that I had a family of cats some years ago, three generations, and the granddaughter in that family gave birth and was not such a good mother, so grandmother got right in there and began nursing the kittens and, in fact, did develop some milk. So that was an interesting...
How did you notice and how could you observe that the actual mother cat wasn't being a good one? Was she ill? Was she just moody or what?
Well, actually what happened was that just before she was due to give birth, our house was robbed and all of the cats were very frightened. And she gave birth and in a state of some agitation and, you know, ran around the house trailing not quite fully born kittens behind her and so forth, whereupon her grandmother and mother sort of took over the process, assisted in the births, ate placentas, washed off kittens, took care of them, and in general stood in for her. It was a really beautiful thing to see.
It's a wonderful account, and it's been replicated in many species. And it's kind of interesting to tie this back into the human case, that in foraging societies, living as our ancestors did in the Pleistocene, the period 1.7 million to 10,000 years ago, when our ancestors lived as hunters and gatherers, there is a tendency for young girls, when they first take lovers and become pregnant and their first marriage, to live close to their mothers. They remain close to the mothers till after the birth of their first child. This is not the first time in history, your cat story, where grandmothers have been there in a pinch to help out in various ways. And it's especially important for mothers at times of stress, or very young mothers, teenage mothers, for example.
Hmm. Pat, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Mike is on the line. Are you there, Mike? Hello, Mike. 1-800-423-8255. Try it again, Mike. 1-800-423-TALK. What is the point about, continue the point about single mothers, teenage mothers, another of the sort of great sort of worry beads of contemporary American society.
Well, when we learn that age of menarche is...
Menarche meaning?
The age when a girl first starts to have her periods.
Ovulate, okay.
And then this is followed by a period of adolescent subfecundity, and she first is able to conceive her babies, maybe a year or so after that. When we learn that the age of fertility is dropping like a rock in our society, and so that girls reach menarche at 12.5 on average, compared to, say, 16 in earlier periods of American history, when we learn this, it's really important to put this in a longer-term perspective, because among our Pleistocene ancestors, what we know is that young women were still dependent on nutritional subsidies from grown-ups. They were still getting food from uncles and aunts and mothers and fathers until they were as old as 18 years old. And what we also know is what's driving this age of menarche down is the sedentary lifestyles these girls are leading and the rich nutrition. Well, in the evolutionary past, it would not have been possible for a girl without a good supportive social situation to get fat enough to ovulate and conceive if she didn't have a good social setup around her. Well, today we have produced these conditions where girls can mature and conceive under anything like supportive social conditions, and then we wonder why these young women don't seem to know what to do, and they panic, and we have these terrible episodes, the baby in the dumpster and so forth. And what we need to understand is that we have altered the conditions of human existence. And it's just like when we go up in airplanes, we pressurize the cabin. When we send these young women out into the world, reproductively mature before they are psychologically mature enough and before they have a supportive social situation, we really need to think about things like sex education and birth control. And by sex education, I mean something a little more substantive than abstinence only, which is just silly.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Mother Nature connection with Sarah Hurdy. Stephen is on the line.
Howdy.
Hello, Stephen.
The question I had was, the animals seem to operate from instincts more so than humans, who seem to operate from emotions. And I was wondering if that was like an accurate observation of the different species.
Stephen, you're absolutely right that humans and animals differ. We have our neocortex and culture and language and our ability to conceptualize our problems, who we are and where we are, certainly makes us very different from animals. However, it's not the emotions that make us different. Emotions are like instincts. Our emotions have an instinctive basis. And I would say that the hormones that urge us to particular emotional responses are very similar in humans and other animals. What makes us different is our hopefully better judgment.
Stephen, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Patrick is on the line. Nice to hear from the guys, Patrick.
Hi, Chris. Hi. I was just calling to ask Sarah. I've heard her mention quite a lot about comparisons with animals and primates, but not too many comparisons with other forms of motherhood around the world. So, for instance, women in the Amazon, women in the Middle East, and I wonder why that was.
Fair question, Patrick.
Well, women in the Amazon, actually I deal with quite a lot, meaning foraging societies in the Amazon. A little bit different perhaps from some of the African cases that I've stressed on, because there's usually more meat in the diet, so that fathers really are very important in the Amazon. And I'm thinking of people like the Aceh in Paraguay that Kim Hill and Hillard Captain Magdalena Hurtado have studied. But really, a lot of the patterns I mentioned, for example, young girls staying near their parents till after the birth of the first child, that is found in the Amazonian region as well. The Middle East, we don't know much about the Middle East till after the Neolithic transition. And the Middle East today is very important, primarily because it offers some of our clearest examples of patriarchal societies and motherhood and patriarchal societies, where maternal choices are very much constrained by male interests having priority. So the Middle East is an interesting example from that respect. I don't talk about them in relation to hunters and gatherers because we really don't know much.
Patrick, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Heidi is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Heidi.
I just had a question. I had my only child when I was 20, and I wondered how the age at which you give birth is a factor in how attached you are to your kids, because I found that compared to other mothers of her friends who are older than I am, I seem to be very attached to her emotionally.
How old is she now, Heidi?
She's 8.
Okay.
I think that any mother prepared to be a mother, interested in being a mother, is going to be a great mother, whether she is a genetic mother or an adoptive mother. Mothers learn through time to really love their babies. However, if we don't look at individual cases and we just look statistically across large numbers, very young mothers, meaning mothers under 19, are at higher risk for not forming close attachments to their infant. This doesn't mean that many won't be very closely attached to their infant, but they are at higher risk for example, infant abandonment. But infant abandonment in our society is actually fairly rare. So we're just talking about a statistical probability. But Heidi, when you gave birth to your first child, who's now 8, did you feel comfortable in your situation at that time, like it was a supportive social situation?
No. I wasn't. It was an unexpected pregnancy. But I think that kind of contributed to me being attached to her, because she became the focus for all of my energies as opposed to everything else that was going on at the time.
Do you want to comment?
It's a lovely story.
It's a beautiful story. It's a wonderful subject. I wish we did this for an hour every week, Sarah Hurdy. Maybe we'll figure out a way to do it. It's an enormously interesting book, Mother Nature, A History of Mothers, Infants, and Natural Selection. Thank you, Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Listeners, you can continue the motherhood conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Cypress Hill Associates, private outpatient treatment for alcohol and other drug problems. In Boston, 975-3800. CypressHillAssociates.com. Mage.